Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello, welcome to the January 4th, 2014 edition of The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, along with Tim McKenna. Happy New Year, Tim.
Happy New Year, Diane.
How was your New Year's Eve?
New Year's Eve was fantastic. It was very quiet.
Mine too. I didn't even watch the ball drop from Times Square. They drop popcorn balls in Chagrin Falls, I hear. Somebody got sticky.
We actually were watching a movie, and I heard noises outside. I heard fireworks, and let's go with fireworks. I don't want to go with gunshots. So.
Yeah, although, who knows? Remember what neighborhoods we live in here. Anyway, from the Outspoken Cyclist to all of our listeners, that you are warm and safe. It is cold and snowy. We are expecting more snow, and according to the weather prognosticators, the, quote, coldest temperatures in years, end quote, coming next week. What do you think?
All I kept thinking on the trip to the station today, normally it takes me about 35, 40 minutes. It took me twice that time, but I was warm, I was dry, and I kept thinking of ice trikes.
Ice trikes. Oh, I heard from ice trikes, by the way. And Maria is in Argentina or somewhere in South America. I'm thinking wherever it's warm, honey. It might have been Chile. But at any rate, as I'm going to be talking with her mom about getting her on the show. Her mom's handling all her PR. But she's taking some R&R.
Well-deserved.
Well-deserved. Well-deserved. So I would like to take a moment to send a shout-out to Andreas Nickman. He is the good-looking son of a former pro cyclist, Roy Nickman. Andreas is kicking cancer in the ass, and we're all here to help support him. I want to wish you and your dad a happy new year, and I hope it's a really, really good one. This evening, we're going to speak with two gentlemen who are involved in very diverse parts of our cycling world. If you have any cycling goals for 2014, my first guest might just be the role model you've been searching for to reach those goals, or even try to expand them. Jim Langley posted the following message to Facebook this past week, and it will give you just a teeny weeny insight into who he is. And I will quote, "Just completed my 7,300th consecutive ride. Translation, 20 years without a day off the bike. I was just a little more than impressed. What do you think?"
That's amazing. I can't even imagine 2 weeks.
Exactly. 7,300 consecutive rides. Well, Jim is the contributing editor at roadbikerider.com. He's the content director at smartetailing.com. Smart Etailing is an organization that helps bike dealers with their websites, and he does a lot of content and technical stuff there. He's a freelance writer for Bicycling Magazine. He's also an author, a bike mechanic, an inventor, and he collects antique bicycles. I think he's immersed.
I think so. He's hooked.
Absolutely. At least 20 years worth. We'll talk with Jim about all things bicycling in a moment and how he has managed to ride for 20 years without a day off the bike. I'm still trying to figure that one out. We have some first of the year news for you. And then we're going to head on over to the UK for a short but informational interview with Dimitris Katsanis. He's the newly appointed head of the UCI Technical Commission. Dimitris, who is the engineering brain behind the 2012 UK's winning Olympic team bikes, will tell us what he'll be doing in the short and long terms to help bring the UCI rules and regulations up to modern day standards. So off we go to what is probably going to be one of the warmer places in the U.S. with one of the more bicycle immersed guys I've ever met. We're going to Santa Cruz, California, and we're going to talk with Jim Langley. Jim, welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me this evening.
Happy New Year to you. Thanks for having me.
Your comments on Facebook blew me away. So tell us a little bit about where you did grow up and how bicycles became such a big part of your main focus.
Well, I was born in Brookline, Massachusetts, actually born in Boston, but I lived back east for the early part of my life. And like everybody, I got a bicycle as a kid. But when I got a bicycle when I was 10 years old, I just decided that it looked like a great escape vehicle, and I started riding longer distances probably than most 10-year-olds do, just to see the area, to explore, and because I loved riding the bike. And the love of riding turned into a passion for bicycles, and it's just never left me. It's been with me my whole life.
What was your first good bike? I'm sure you remember. You probably still have it.
No, I don't still have it. The first bike was a J.C. Higgins one-speed.
People nice.
Wouldn't call it a, you know what? People wouldn't call it a good bike, but to me it was a good bike because it actually was an adult-sized bicycle, and I could go long distance on it and not get tired. But the first bike I had came a little later that had gears, and that was a Phillips three-speed. With three speeds, you could go a lot further and get up hills, and it had handbrakes. So that was just your basic three-speed bicycle. Nothing fancy, but it made it easier to ride further.
That was my first good bike, a Phillips three-speed girls bike in dark green.
Yeah, they were great. They were the English racer. Did you call them an English racer?
That's what we called them. I did indeed. That is, and you know what? It got stolen off my back porch.
Oh, yeah, that's a common problem even today.
Yes, it is. So you grew up in on the East Coast, and now you're in California. How come you settled out there?
Well, it's kind of, you know, if you work in New England, I went to work in bicycle shops around 1970.
Yeah.
During high school, I went to work in bicycle shops. And, you know, then in the New England, the bicycle business is absolutely crazy from about late February, early March, all the way through to the first snow. But once the snow hits, the cold weather comes, the bikes get put away and the cross-country skis come out. And I wanted to work where bicycle fever existed year-round. And, you know, I followed all the magazines, read all the books, and I knew that the West Coast, especially the L.A. area and up and down the California, people were just crazy about bikes 24/7, 365. And I had an idea that I wanted to head west sometime. So we made it happen. My wife and I rode our bikes across country, and we ran out of money, just happened to run out of money in Santa Cruz, and that's how we ended up in Santa Cruz, basically.
What year was that you rode cross country?
We rode cross country in 1979, so you know, you'll remember the passion for cross country riding with Bike Centennial in 1976.
Sure.
So we saw all that, and at the bike shop, we set up lots of people that did that, and we wanted to experience that, riding across country. But we did it kind of our own way. We left, at the time I was in, we were both in college in Keene, New Hampshire, at Keene State College. And we rode from there down to Florida, Gainesville, Florida, and then we rode across the bottom of the United States. The original idea was to ride the perimeter of the United States. But that looked a lot easier on a map than it actually turned out to be.
How long did that take you?
We rode 5,000 miles, and it took 117 days, and that included some time hanging around in various places. You know, the thing about riding around the perimeter is for a long part of the way, you're right along the ocean, and it gets uncomfortable after a while with the sun hitting you all day and the same scenery the whole time. So we just decided to shorten it a little bit. But it takes a special person to go out there and keep going and keep going. I mean, there are people that ride around the world. They just impress me to pieces.
Oh, wait a minute. When we get to your stats, you're going to say that's not impressive. We're going to get there. It's cool that you're impressed by somebody else, though. That's very cool. You know this girl, Maria Lagerstam, who just rode to the South Pole?
Wow, I don't know that name.
Yeah,
that
she beat a whole bunch of people who started 3 days ahead of her. And she made it. Yeah, on a trike, a big, fat, tired trike. Anyway, we don't often talk about retail and the retail segment on the show, but you work with a unique company. Tell us a little bit about Smart E-Tailing and what it is you're doing to help dealers who are struggling a little bit. And I know that's part of it right now with the online stuff.
Yeah, so Mark Graff and Barry Brenner founded Smart E-Tailing. Both those guys are from the bicycle industry. You knew Mark. He was at Catalyst. But before that, he was at Eclipse Panniers.
Right, that's how I met him and Leslie from Eclipse.
Yeah, great people. And Barry is similar bike shop background. He owned a bike shop called Cycle Scene in Ventura, California. And Mark and Barry saw a need for something right around 1999. They both had the idea we should put together a website solution for bicycle shops, because that was kind of the, in 1999 happened to be the big internet crash, but Mark and Barry thought it was still the perfect time to help bicycle shops and be the independent retailer by providing a website solution. So the idea was to provide sort of a turnkey, you pay a monthly fee, and then you have a turnkey website solution. All the content, all the tools, all the catalog, the product that you need, and the bike shop just pays the monthly fee, and they have this really nice professional website, and gives the bike shop an opportunity to compete online with the other giants like eBay and Amazon and all these competitors that are out there that are taking sales away from the small bike shops. And we come from the bike industry, so we want to help the bicycle industry, and whether people realize it or not, that the bicycle suppliers, the Treks and the Giants and the Specialized of the world, they mainly rely on the bicycle retailers to sell their products. So even though you can buy that stuff on Amazon and eBay and all the other online sources, the big person working the hardest is the small bike shop. And so we try to provide something for the bike shop. And it's changed over the years. We've been doing this for 13 years. And Barry is technically brilliant. He understands online tools, computers, software, coding. He's a real genius that way. He always also understands the bicycle industry. And Mark comes at it from sales and marketing and product knowledge and a similar passion for the bicycle industry. And when you put their two brains together, you get, they keep pushing forward. So what's happened is they've figured out a technological solution that gives the retailer even more power to fight against these big online services. And what we call it is Buy Local Now. I don't know if you've seen that in the press or not. Have you seen any news on that?
Sure. Yeah.
And what that does, it sounds like some, a lot of people say, oh, that already existed, but it actually didn't exist. What happens is, on the supplier's site, people search for product, and when they click to find a local dealer to purchase that product, they often end up on a dead end. What we've done is sync the inventory of the supplier with the inventory of the bike shop, and when you click Buy Local Now, it actually goes out and finds where those products are available right now, local to you, and you can actually go to that store and purchase that item right there and right then. It's not a hit or miss. You know for sure that the product is available right now. That's powerful stuff. Well, you can go on Amazon, get something in 2 days if you have Amazon Prime. And Amazon is starting to do same-day delivery, but they haven't quite rolled it out yet. So the bicycle shop actually has an advantage that they have that part in stock. You can find it very quick, go right down to your favorite shop and buy it. That's very popular. It's popular with the manufacturer, I mean the suppliers, and it's popular with the bike shops. It's free to the bike shops. It's there's a cost to the suppliers to set it all up because it's a technological marriage between the Specialized and Giants and Treks and the bicycle shop. The back ends of their websites have to talk to each other.
Let me just take a moment to remind our listeners, we're speaking with Jim Langley. He's on his way to one of my favorite places out on the West Coast. I won't tell you right now, but it is one of my favorite places. Anyway, what is it you're doing then for smart e-tailing? All right, I understand how that's working, and I know there are several shops right here in Northeast Ohio that use smart e-tailing for their website template. What is it that you're bringing to that party?
Essentially, I'm a bicycle expert, but I do it through being a technical writer for smart detailing. So my title is content director, and content has to do everything from catalogs, so product descriptions, specifications, prices, part numbers, to stories about how to fix a flat tire, to video product reviews, anything that's content, that's what I'm in charge of. I work with a team of bike geeks just like me, but they all happen to be in Boulder, Colorado. So we have 11 people in our Boulder, Colorado office, and we work together to generate content so that our bike shops have the latest content and the best content. And my job is to direct that whole content effort and to produce content, but most of my time is spent working with my team of people and helping them get the best content, and I edit and write and fix proof a lot of content, because everything has to get proof, as you know, to make sure there aren't mistakes, make sure it's as good as it can be, because we're not, when we put our stuff out there on the Bicycle Shop website, we want it to appear like the Bicycle Shop created this content, and so we have to be responsible to the bike shops to make sure we don't, I mean, imagine what would happen if we said a $2,000 bicycle costs $200.
Yeah, that would create some interest right away, but probably one that the bike shop wouldn't appreciate. How many bike shops right now are using the smart e-tailing system?
So our setup is cool. There's no, when you sign up with smart e-tailing, there's no long-term commitment. You could sign up one day and call us up the next day and say, I don't want to do this anymore.
Huh.
So because of that, we fluctuate. It almost fluctuates every couple of days. We'll sign up in new shops. A shop will say, I can't afford it anymore. But our number is roughly 1,100 bicycle shops across the United States and into Canada. And we started 13 years ago. When we first started out, we had about 40 shops, and we thought we'd be lucky to get to 400. So we're pretty happy where we're at with 1,100 shops.
Yeah, well, that's about, what, 16-17% of the known bike shops in the country. That's pretty good.
It's pretty good, and, you know, a lot of shops are smaller shops. They
right.
can't really afford a website solution. They do it themselves, which
right.
is great. You know, we tell people the most important thing is that you have a presence online. After that, if you want to take it up a notch and have a catalog and have a technical connection with suppliers, and then you might want to talk to us, but we don't insist you have to have smart e-tailing, but we do tell any bike shop you should have a website.
Right. Well, I would hope that most of them do by now. Let me ask you a question about some of the technical things that you do talk to people about. What are some of the things that you might say are don't try this at home things? So, you know, I know a lot of people do work on their own bikes, and I give them a lot of credit, especially if they're technically astute. But there are certain things that, especially tool-wise, bike shops are so much better at. For example, building wheels, in my opinion, is something an artisan needs to do it well. What other things do you think, or do you advise people to go to the bike shop to have done?
Well, for 11 years, I was a technical editor at Bicycling Magazine, and I covered all topics, but probably my favorite thing, the thing people read the most, two things. One was a column called Repair Stand, where we told people how to fix their own bike, and another column was called Tech Q&A, where people would ask questions about their bike, and I would tell them how to fix it or what the problem was or where to go to fix it. And, you know, that was from about 1988 to about 1999, late 1999. Well, things have changed drastically since then. Some of the modern bicycle components are incredibly sophisticated. Just take carbon fiber as a simple example. An awful lot of bicycles today are built of carbon fiber. As amazing as carbon fiber is, it's a little bit of a mystery. If you crashed a steel bike in the old days, you could see the crash damage. You didn't have to be a genius. You could look at it and see the wrinkles in the steel and know that there was a problem.
Right.
Today with you remember that.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Well, today with a carbon bike, let's say that you're riding with your buddies, you just stop paying attention, or a dog runs out, you look at the dog and forget that you're riding right behind somebody, and you flip over the handlebars, you don't know whether your bicycle is damaged or not by looking at it. You
right.
might be able to see some scratches, but you don't know. Now, there are tests you can do. Tapping on the frame with a quarter and listening for differences in sound is one test. You know, flexing the tube and seeing if you can feel a problem. But in reality, the only way to find out if you really damaged the carbon frame is to send it to a carbon frame expert. Sometimes you send back to the manufacturer. A lot of manufacturers these days will send you to a specialist like Calfee in...
In Santa Cruz, actually.
He's in Santa Cruz, yeah.
Right.
And then he does a huge business in evaluating crash damage on carbon frames. That's just one example. I mean, an awful lot of people at the higher end now riding electric drivetrains. And there are some things that are very tricky to figure out with this electric shifting drivetrains if you have a problem. Now, fortunately, the problems aren't that many problems out there that I've been aware of. But I do get emails from people that are having issues that can't figure it out. And sometimes, even when they bring it to the shop and the shop uses the recommended diagnostic tools that they have that are relatively expensive, even the shop sometimes has to return it to the manufacturer in order to have it reconfigured or reprogrammed so that it works right. So I'm all for people trying to fix their own bike. One of the reasons I got into bicycles is because it's such a nice, user-friendly thing, a bicycle. You know, they're wonderful to ride, but they're just as much fun to work on, in my opinion. Although you have to be a little realistic. The modern bikes are getting more high-tech and a little trickier to fix.
I agree with all of that. Once again, we are speaking with Jim Langley. He is on the West Coast, where we are freezing and deep in snow here on the East Coast. So one of the things that brought you to my radar this week was your comment on Facebook that you have ridden an incredible number of consecutive times, 7,300 or 20 years worth. Where are you as of 12/31/13? How many miles do you have cumulatively on a bicycle or bicycles? Or number of days, really. It was the number of consecutive rides.
Yeah, 7,302. That's the total.
Oh, my good. And so what does that really represent? I mean, if we look at it, break that down for me.
It represents obsession. extreme stubbornness and determination. But, you know, it all started. I told you I was working at Bicycling Magazine.
Right.
And I worked with some pretty inspirational guys, Ed Pavelka and Fred Matheny. Those guys had set a Race Across America record. They were in their 50s, and they smashed the record riding across the country as a team. So it was, I was thinking, you know, I don't know that I'm as great an athlete as those guys, that I could go out and set a world record. So what could I do? And I started remembering in high school that when I was a runner, we used to try to see how many days in a row we could run. And I thought, maybe I could ride my bike every day. So in 1990, I started riding my bike every day, and I almost made it 3 years. And then I have a certificate from one of my coworkers at Bicycling Magazine. He made me this beautiful certificate that congratulated me for riding 1,000 days in a row. But it wasn't but 5 days after that I hit some black ice in the Santa Cruz Mountains and fell off my bike and broke my hip. And that ended that streak.
Oh, no. When was that? Now, what year was that?
So that's the first streak, which was almost 3 years, ended on December 23rd in 1990. That was the day that I broke my hip. No, 93.
Okay.
That was the day that I broke my hip.
Okay.
December 23rd, 1993.
Okay.
So I had to take some time off the bike because they had to put me back together again.
I found Darn.
Out that it's a really common accident for cyclists.
Yes, it is, especially on ice.
Yeah, and I didn't know that. And I thought maybe I'd never ride again, but the surgeon just laughed and said, no, this happens all the time and you'll be fine. And sure enough, 6 days after surgery, I was able to start riding on a trainer again.
Wow, that's rehab.
Rehab, exactly right.
Right.
They said it's unusual. It depends on what type of a break you have. And I rode one-legged when I started back out again. But so December 30th, 1993 was the day I started my streak back up again. And at that time, I said, okay, I'm going to make it 10 years. That's going to be my goal, 10 years. And so 10 years came and went like nothing, you know, looking back at it. And so I said, well, let's keep it going. So I did keep it going. And the other day, the 29th of 2013, I eclipsed 20 years of consecutive daily rides.
Do you consider just getting on the bike and riding 5 miles a daily ride? I mean, or do you do that?
No, no. So this was an honor system. It was a pledge I made to myself. I didn't put this out there. I told some friends of mine, but I just made a commitment to myself that I was going to ride every day and be honest to myself. And for it to be an honest ride to me, I have to suit up, have to get my kit on, I have to get on the bike, and I have to ride a real ride. So to me, a real ride has to be about an hour long or longer.
Okay.
And it could be commuting to work and back. It could be a real ride, like a group ride with friends. It could be a race. I mean, it has to be a real ride. You have to be actually out riding. If I just ride down the street to get a quart of milk, that's not going to be considered a ride.
Okay. Do you have a number of miles that adds up to these 20 years?
No, I'd have to do the math. It's funny. People say, don't you write every single ride down and all the
no.
stats? And I don't, but you could estimate, you know, so if you were going to be real, if I was going to be real modest, I should do this, but I would say, okay, let's say my average pace is 16 miles an hour. And let's say that I never rode more than an hour, but I would say my average ride was more like 90 minutes, over all those, 20 years. So you could, if you did that, you could just do the math and figure it out. But I haven't done that yet, Diane. I don't, to me, it's enough just to have that commitment and get out there every day, get your ride in. And I can also ride indoors. So if I lived where you were, I would be riding a trainer.
Yeah, no kidding. Yes, you would.
Ride is hard. No, you have to. Even in Northern California, we don't get the weather you guys get, but it can get rainy, endlessly rainy, and it can be pretty cold and uncomfortable. Not like what you guys have, but, you know, we're softer out here.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, really, we're really hardcore. My bike's been on a trainer for I don't know how long right now. Anyway, so you did allude to a race. So did you ever race bikes?
Oh, yeah. I've been racing for years now. I mean, I'm sort of a competitive person, so... And cycling is fun. It's you know, racing bicycles is chess on wheels. It's not so rare. It's very rare that the strongest person wins. It's the strongest and the smartest. And there's so many different types of racing: mountain biking, triathlon, cyclocross. I even race my high wheel bicycle, which is pretty hilarious. I mean, that's really
hilarious.
Funny.
You're right.
It's really, really funny when you get a bunch of people on these high wheel bikes from 110 years ago and you go racing around a Criterium. It's hilarious.
Have you ever considered taking a non-cycling vacation?
No, I would never take a vacation and not ride my bike. That wouldn't make sense to me.
So do you take vacations?
Yeah, we take vacations, but the bike always comes. So for traveling and vacations, I have a bike Friday that goes in a suitcase.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, and so when we go to Maui, which is one of our, well, it's getting a little expensive, but we used to go there. We went there two or three times, and I would ride up Haleakala on my little folding bike, which is a spectacular ride. Have you ever done that?
I have not done it yet. I know about it, but what about coming down?
Oh, that's the best part.
On your bike Friday, that would be funny. Don't they use mountain bikes a lot up coming down that mountain?
Yeah, people pay money to take a tour, and the touring company takes them up, and then they let them bomb down the hill. The idea is to see the sunrise up there. It's spectacular, and then you bomb down the hill, but they don't really let you go fast. They have a guy in the back that makes sure you can't go too slow, and have a guy in the front that makes sure you can't go too fast.
It's like a governor, huh?
Yeah, exactly, because they've had a lot of people crash. And if you crash on the mountain, you crash on those volcanic rocks. They're very sharp. So
probably hurts a lot, huh?
Yeah, it hurts a lot.
Yeah. So
you don't want to go with them. If you go, Diane, you want to do the ride on your own so you can decide how fast you come down.
Yeah, well, I'd be crawling probably. I'm not gutsy.
Very safe road. It's wide open.
Oh, okay.
Smooth surface. It's very safe.
So, nice.
Yeah, you'd love it. It's a tough climb, though. It took me 5 hours to get to the top.
Ugh. I have one more question for you, and then I'm going to let you go and enjoy your time out there. Do you have any new projects coming up for 2014?
Well, I've got my blog that I try to update on a regular basis.
What's your blog address? What's your blog site?
It's my name, so jimlangley.blogspot.com. And people can follow along there. And I have a weekly column on roadbikerider.com. And I try to keep that up to date with product reviews and news and tips for the readers. We have about 70,000 readers. That's a source for people getting into road biking. You know, there's tons of information out there for mountain biking, but it's kind of hard to find good resource for road biking. So we've had this for about 12 years now, and we have a good following, and it's a way to keep up with news and tips and new products. It's just a fun way to learn about road riding if you're not an expert. We talk more to, well, there are some experts, but there are a good number of beginners that find us, and we get them started too.
Well, this has been such a fun conversation. I really appreciate you taking time to talk to me today, and I hope you have a really nice time out there in California where it's warm and sunny while we're slogging through the snow back here.
Thank you very much.
All right, have a happy new year. Thanks. All righty. Bye-bye. Jim Langley joined us from his car, actually, out in California. What an interesting conversation. Okay, you did the math. What is it?
Well, if my cell phone or my smartphone is as smart as it's supposed to be, it's 7,300 days at roughly 24 miles a day. That's over 175,000 miles.
It's funny that he doesn't keep track of mileage. He keeps track of how many consecutive days, because everybody keeps track of mileage. That is just awesome.
I think at that point, at 7,300, that's the more important number. Keep that up.
I think so, too. We're going to take a short break on The Outspoken Cyclist. We'll be right back on WJCU.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU University Heights.
On Saturday, January 11th, join Cleveland Metro Parks for a winter photo hike at Lookabout Lodge in South Chagrin Reservation. Bundle up for this 1.5-mile walk as it steps off at 9 a.m., and be sure to bring your camera to capture the sights along a wintry trail. Be prepared for hills, stairs, and slippery conditions. Lookabout Lodge is located at 37374 Miles Road in Bentleyville. More information at 440-247-7075 or go to clevelandmetroparks.com. Click on Events.
I'm Diane Lees.
And this is Tim McKenna.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist, and it's time for some news. The first item I have, and I know you've got a lot of items, this is from Momentum Magazine. It was written by Carolyn Zapansky. Carolyn actually works for the League of American Bicyclists, and it's an infographic. It's very interesting. It's actually from April, but they republished it again. How Bicycles Bring Business, the infographic. And it's just this little, four little panels, cycling and house sales. So people buy houses because of access to cycling infrastructure, whether it's trails, whether it's, you know, paved streets with sharrows, all kinds of stuff. And then New York car-centric streets versus New York bike-friendly streets. Well, our friend Jeanette Sadiq Khan, who is the transportation commissioner, has shown, and I think we talked last week about her report that's available about how much business these stores can do by having access to bicycles, you know, by having parking racks outside and easy to get to. So it's a nice infographic. If you want to see it, I think all you have to do is type in How Bicycles Bring Business, the infographic, Momentum Magazine.
And I think it's great to see that more cities are actually building that into the plan. It's just so many times we've seen they just plop something down and say, let's do this, and right, wait 5 years to decide it doesn't work.
Well, and part of that is the complete streets thing. So if somebody actually enacts complete streets, it already calls for all of those changes to be made as these streets come online with either new striping or widening or narrowing or whatever they do.
Next we have up, and this is a Kickstarter campaign, and I love Kickstarter and programs like that. It's great to get products like this off the ground. It's the Zachy's Turn Signal Gloves.
Yes, indeed.
And actually, as of the date of the airing of this, you still have a couple of days yet that you can get in on the Kickstarter campaign. And the neat thing about the glove is it actually has arrows on it that you use as a turn signal when you're on your bike. You stick your hand out and there's a little contact there you put with your thumb and your finger, and when you touch the two points, it actually will turn it on. So it's not on all the time that you're riding. It's only when you...
I thought you had a good idea, and that was to have turn signals on your butt.
Yeah, put them on your cheeks. So when you have it there, and then also you have it on the back at the same time. The nice thing about this, though, is when you're riding, and if you keep your hands on the handlebars, people can see from the front also.
Right.
So
right.
You can do from the front and from the side.
So it's Zachy, Z-A-C-H-E-S, as I remember?
Z-A-C-K-E-E-S.
Oh, Zachy's. Okay.
Yeah. So if you just search on Kickstarter, you'll find it. And you still have the opportunity to get in. The advantage of helping out with this campaign is you'll get a pair of gloves cheaper than you will be able to
once they
actually come out.
And as I understand, the campaign is fully funded.
Yes, they're above being funded, so this is something that's out there, and it's a great use of the interwebs.
Very cool. This comes from Bike Radar, our buddies. It's interesting. Bike Radar now says, so when you type in Bike Radar, it says, well, given where you're coming from, meaning they knew I was in the U.S., maybe you want the U.S. version. I went, no, I like the U.K. version. So new U.K. beach bike race announced. I thought this was really cool. This was announced on December 31st. Entries open tomorrow, which was the first, for an event which claims to be the first ever beach bike race on UK sand. The Howie-sponsored Battle on the Beach will take place on March 16th at Pembrey Country Park in South Wales and will be run over an 8-kilometer loop. Beach racing is thriving in the Netherlands, which makes use of the country's wide, windswept North Sea beaches. However, while the Dutch mass participation events are usually run out and back to make use of the wind, the Welsh looped version will be more technical, offering sand dunes, single track, and a few surprises, according to the event website. Those surprises are likely to include riding through old military installations in the dunes once used by the armed forces. Entrance will be split into open, veteran, and fun/youth fields. There's a subcategory for fat bikes, too. Top prize, they're giving money, is £250 to the winners of the male and female races. But be warned. Bike Radar believes experienced beach racers from the Dutch Koga mountain bike team could be traveling over for the event. If you're considering entering, take a look at Ramesses Beckens Bike for some kit choices. So, I don't know about this racing in sand. It's sort of like slogging through, but it sounds like fun.
They used to, I know they used to in England, and they did that down at Daytona. In the U.S. for a long time, they would set land speed records on the sand.
Huh. Okay.
And just because of the instability of it for the cars, and they got so fast, they changed it. But for a bike, obviously, we would hope that there'd be no cars in the way. So
that would be very nice. Dune buggies.
That would be, yes.
Dune buggy runs into sight. Oh, God, that's all we need. Maybe this would be cool. That's true. There wouldn't be any cars. That would be awesome. Very cool. All right, what's next on your list?
The next one I have is a nice fun story. Drew Buck, a 65-year-old from Somerset, and this comes from the BBC. This is the sixth time that he's competed in the PBP, or the Paris-Brest-Paris race. This race is 770 miles, and you have to complete it within 90 hours. And this time he did it exactly as they did in the 1900s. And the neat accessory that he took with him was onions. It was just, that was part of his whole costume, as it were. He did the entire thing with fake onions because the real onions didn't last very long, but he was able to complete it. He is the master of the 10-minute catnap. And he says, as you get older, your strength fades, but your stamina stays with you. So he's not sure if he's going to be back in 2015, but he was able to complete this one, which was a
really neat thing. Where were these onions?
Really,
like in a basket
No, he had them tied on the handlebars.
That's hilarious. Well, we have some friends here in Northeast Ohio who have done PBP successfully. I have one friend who is hoping to do 10 of them. He says, I was the inspiration for him to do his first one. I'm still trying to remember how that came about. But, yeah, it's quite the event. quite the event. All right, I have the video of the week. There is a very famous bike designer builder in England by the name of Mike Burrows. And this says, ready? Video. Can recumbent bikes climb hills? Well, everybody's always said that recumbents are killer going downhill. You know, you can just zoom because you've got all that momentum and you're low to the ground and all of that aerodynamic and all that. But riding up hills, they're a pain. Mike Burrows said, maybe not. In a video in madegood.org, Burrows says that recumbent bikes such as the Rat Racer SL can climb faster than standard bikes in the right conditions. Burrows said, quote, riding up a sustained hill on a laid-back bicycle up to a certain point in terms of heart rate is actually slightly faster than a regular bike of the same weight. However, Burrows, who has made a series of videos for bike maintenance website madegood.org, adds a caveat that at maximal effort, the traditional bike will inevitably catch up. Well, at any rate, I think the fun part is just watching them. It's a 1 minute and 40 second video on YouTube. Can you climb hills on a recumbent bike? So that's my pick for the video of the week.
So would you try to climb a hill with a recumbent?
I don't ride recumbents. I've tried. They are, you know what? They're really, really fast.
It's an entirely different animal, sort of. I mean, it just takes a...
It is.
After we've been setting our ways for so long doing one thing, nice to take the challenge.
You know, but I'm the little turbo on the back of the tandem. I like climbing. I do like climbing. I don't not like climbing, but I like having my captain up there setting the pace. What you got?
One of the other stories that we have today is, and this is keeping with the theme of can't we just all get along, in Australia, a cyclist got hit by an egg from a moving vehicle.
Oh,
someone
geez.
Actually threw an egg out. He said when it hit him, it felt like a brick hit him. It was traveling so fast, and it just he felt that he was also shot by a paintball gun. It's just crazy what cyclists have to deal with on just a regular basis with everything. So that's the not so fun story. One of the other things is in one of the top 10 lists that I found last week. It has to do with bike bullies. Turn off those blinking lights.
Yeah, there's like a couple of things about that. Some people love them and some people go, get them out of my face.
Well, and there's a lot to be said for making yourself visible, but at the same time irritating the other people that you're driving against in traffic or with. The standard automobile headlight emits somewhere in the range of 700 lumens on standard, and you can get up to 1500 lumens on high beam. But thanks to lithium batteries and LEDs and everything else that we have today, you can get up to 3,600 lumens on a bicycle light, which is way too much, flashing and everything else
so
that goes with
it. Basically
that.
Blinding somebody.
You're blinding someone and you're irritating them significantly as well, which and many European countries actually have limits on what the output can be.
Yeah.
And we actually have it in the United States, but most people don't realize what it is. The other thing in Europe and a lot of places, it also bans blinkers on the rear and the back of the bike also.
That is correct.
Which the Zaki's campaign would work out just fine because that's actually up on the side.
Right.
Not flashing
on the
glovies. Backside.
Right.
Right. So it's again, be safe. Light up as much as you need to, but you don't have to be.
You mean if you got them, light them?
Yeah. Yeah, right. Pretty much.
I have one more, and then I think you have one more, too. So my last one is about Leadville. Now, we know Rob Jones is going to try and do Leadville.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about that a few weeks ago. Registration opened January 1st for the 2014 Leadville Race Series events and camps. So the Leadville 100 will take place August 16th. If you are interested in becoming a participant, there is a lottery. The race lottery is for the 21st annual Leadville Trail 100 MTB, actually opened on the 1st of November. Lottery winners will be randomly selected by February 28th, the end of February. I assume you can still get into the lottery. I'm not sure. But at any rate, I'll be watching Leadville this year to see who comes home with a big belt buckle.
That's something I'd love to just watch.
Yeah. I thought you were going to say, oh, I'd like to do that. No,
that's okay. I'm wise enough to know better.
Yeah, okay.
Last story that I'll have for now is 11 reasons why bicycling in the U.S. is exceptionally dangerous.
Nice. Is this how we're ending the news? Okay.
Well, the interesting right. thing about this is it's all in the headlines. And initially, the headline that linked me to this said why the U.S. is more dangerous than in Europe. And that's basically they give us a lot of comparisons. And Americans are not only among the world's least avid cyclists, they are also among the most likely to get killed.
Nice.
And a lot of this, again, has to do with what we've talked about the last couple of weeks about making sure that we share the roadway, we're responsible with what we do, and we tend to have more incidents of running into ourselves, running into cyclists.
Into each other. Mm-hmm. So my little story about that is if you go way back when roads first were allowing cars. So originally, roads were built for bikes. And then cars started coming onto the roadways. And sure enough, there are tons of these little videos. I mean, then they were little movies of cars. You know, you have one road, it goes nowhere. And what are these cars doing? Smacking into one another. It's pretty funny, actually. I'm like, really? Yeah, they're going 10 miles an hour and they can't see each other and stop in time? I don't know.
Well, I think with all the things that we see with the driverless cars that they're talking about
yes.
for the future, I think maybe that might get to the point where it'll certainly help out with all the sensors and everything else you're going to need to keep distance from another car. Hopefully, they'll be able to keep that from a cyclist as well.
Well, that would be nice. Well, that's a nice way to end the news this week. All right. We are actually going to head on over to the UK and speak with Dimitris Katsanis. Dimitris is an engineer. He is a brilliant engineer. He has been tapped by the UCI to take over the Tech Commission. So let's hear what Dimitris has to say. He and I did a Skype interview just before the holidays. That's when I was able to catch up with him. Dimitris Katsanis. Hello, Dimitris. Thank you for joining me on the Outspoken Cyclist today.
Hi. Hello, Diane.
I want to talk about a lot of things with you, but how about a little bit of background? You're the brains behind the bikes for the British team at the London Olympics. Tell us a little bit about how you came into the bicycle engineering. I know you come from another part of the engineering world.
Yeah. Okay, I was into cycling pretty much all my life. And in fact, my first attempt into cycling was like I was cycling myself. I was reasonably good, but not really world-class level. I raced a few international races here and there, but I wasn't by any stretch of imagination a world champion or anything. And then, in fact, my first degree is actually in sports science and physical education, but then I, at that time, I was in Greece, which is where I come from originally, and I realized that I was always good in engineering and so on. So in the early 90s, I decided I'll go on and study engineering. So I came to England and I studied composites engineering in the early to mid 90s. And although I was always running, like in the background, all sorts of cycling projects and so on, for a number of years, for eight years, for a company that was one of the pioneers in composite materials, you know, all this carbon fiber and so on. And I was very lucky on that, I have to say, because as an engineer working for a company like that, I dealt with a huge variety of projects, things that they had to do from aeroplanes to sports cars to medical equipment to things that they had to do on industrial machinery and so on. So it was very good that I was not dealing with only one aspect of engineering, but I was like a very wide range of materials and applications and so on.
Well, that's a good thing, because certainly composites have come a long way in our sport. And obviously, yeah, that background gives you a lot of latitude in terms of understanding how it works. You were a track sprinter. Are you still riding?
I'm riding nowhere near as much as I would like to be fair. I have to say, I do ride primarily like summertime, you know, in England, the
sure.
weather is not exactly the best. Although I have to say, a lot of people, they actually do wintertime over here. I'm always saying all due respect to these people, but I prefer it when it's nice, go out, because it gives me the time to go out and think also. So quite a few of the ideas on the bikes and so on, they actually coming to me as I'm riding the bike, and I'm saying, what if I do this? What if I do that? And it works very well for me.
I think a lot of people find their minds become more clear when they ride and all those ideas mm-hmm. start to flow. I understand perfectly what you're saying. So the exciting news is that last week, as of last week, you've become part of the UCI's Equipment Commission with the task of updating the 1997 charter that was, I read it and it was kind of vague to me. I couldn't quite understand what they were getting at, but when I look at people like Graham O'Bree, for example, and Chris Boardman, people who had restrictions that were sort of not real clear why, you know, like cutting the nose off the front of his saddle, Graham O'Bree, for example. Tell us what the charter said then and what those consequences have been for cycling since then.
Yeah, the general idea behind the Lugano Charter, it is the primacy of man over machine. So in effect, it says that the athlete is more important than the bike. And that is more or less of a consequence of what it was happening in the early to mid-90s, that the regulations, they were relaxed, and perhaps the people that they were enforcing the regulations at that time, they were caught up a little bit off guard, and the Lugano Charter was very much an attempt of trying to get back some control. So the basic idea, the basic principle, in fact, is actually quite good, and I do in general agree with that. Of course, we need to move up with times, and we need to allow innovation, and we need to allow the sport to develop and progress. So my job, it will be primarily to look of what is happening today, where are we in terms of regulations, and what is happening out there in the real world, and try and bring the two together.
So you will be looking at everything from fit, including fit, and the bike itself, and then the components, all of that. You're going to have that. That's a huge task, it sounds like.
Yes, we're not going to do everything at once. It's not going to be a free-for-all and let's go and do whatever we want. So the first stage of that, it will be very much like a fact-finding mission, trying to understand of where we are today, what the teams, what the manufacturers, what perhaps the public to some extent thinks of where we are and what it could be done. Of course, you will have like a number of people that will want to stay with what we have. You will have another range of people that they want complete liberty. But of course, we're going to need to find very much like the golden rule of where the balance lies in all that. We do need to move with the times, and that is the main aim. We're going to start primarily with road and track, because traditionally this is where cycling is coming from. And of course, after that, when this task is accomplished, we're going to be looking at what is happening on other disciplines too.
Well, I know that it was announced, I think this week, that one of the, I think it was wheels, were going to be put off for a while. Some of these new aero carbon wheels, we're going to move, not do any regulation with that, that they will not yet be allowed. Is that right? Did I read that correctly?
There was a new set of regulations to come in force with regards to the wheels. What the UCI announced, it was that these specific regulations, they will be reviewed, and we're going to need to look if this is the best way of approaching this particular subject matter or not. So it's not that this is scrapped completely or anything like this, but we're going to just need to look at it. Is this the best way? And for me, it's a bit too early to say what it will happen, because to give you an idea, my appointment officially starts from the 1st of January.
Okay. Yes, of course. Do you feel that the election of Brian Cookson and then your appointment is signaling a really positive change for the UCI? Do you think that the UCI was really going down the wrong road before this? I know it's a bad question.
No, it is a question that I think only history can give you the answer, perhaps in a few years' time, when we know what happened and we can judge of how successful Brian Cookson and myself and the other people around him, we were at that time. So I I did notice that a lot of people, they do see this as a positive. I also see it as a positive, but as I said, I don't want to judge something too early. Let's wait and see what we can do, what Brian Cookson can do, and perhaps we can speak again in a few years' time and see if we've done it right or not.
Well, that would be really nice that both of us are still doing these things. That would be awesome. So you begin in January, and now are you going to be able to work from England, or are you going to have to travel to go do this work? Where are these meetings?
I will have to travel. I'm not going to be based in Switzerland. I will have to go to the UCI several times because there will be meetings over there, but there will also be meetings in other places around the world because cycling is not only based in Switzerland. There are other places around the world that we're going to need to go and visit and try to find out primarily what is the situation in different parts of the world. But most of the time I will be actually working from the UK, but there will also be quite a lot of traveling involved.
Well, I have to say that I am very excited to see changes in the UCI. Whether, as you said, we'll have to wait to see whether they are positive or not. But my hope, and I think everybody's hope, is that this is a new direction that's going to bring cycling back into people's lives in a positive way. We've had an awful lot of negative stuff in 2013. So this, I hope, will signal a whole new era for cycling. And I really appreciate you talking with me about your job with that. And I will check back with you, I promise, in the not-too-distant future.
Okay, that's great.
Thank you so much, Demetrius. Have a very happy new year.
Happy new year to you, too.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Demetrius Katsanis joined me from his home in the UK, as he said he will be traveling around to different parts of the world to check on equipment and the technical aspects of cycling. I think it does signal a new cycling era, and I'm very excited about it. That is pretty much our show for this week. I'm going to see you again next week. Yes, Mr. McKenna?
Yes. If we could do this every day with all the interesting guests you keep bringing on here, this should be more than once a week.
You know, don't tempt me.
I know.
Remember, I teach a lot of yoga. I do a couple other things, but I do love this. This is the most fun. This is much better than unlocking the door of a retail store every day. I really enjoy it. Well, I hope you enjoyed listening to the show this week. We will be back next week with a very special show about the Rwandan cycling team. We're speaking with Jacques Boyer, who is the coach. We're speaking with the author of a new book about the Rwandan cycling team, Mr. Owens. He wrote a book called Second Chances. And then on January 23rd, Rising from Ashes will be previewing here in Cleveland at the Cedar Lee Theater. So stay tuned. Come back. Have a great week. Oh, stay warm and dry. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at wjcu.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at wjcu.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.